Yeah. I wish I could come up to the introduction, but no, I can't talk about the general thing of statistics and how we use it. I talked to Herbert yesterday, and this talk just started then, so it's something I threw together last night. So what I'm actually going to present to you is a little fitting problem that we're currently working through in our work, but which I think is a pretty general problem for lattice gauge simulations. And it's to extract the nucleon mass from measured correlation functions on the lattice. And this is, ever since the first hadron spectrum calculations, been a bit of an embarrassment for people who do staggered fermions. Although I don't think there's anything special to staggered fermions in the source of it. And that is that when we use different operators at the source and sink ends of our quark propagators, we don't always get the same answers for the masses. So first let me explain exactly how these things are computed on the lattice. And what one does is, on one or maybe a couple of adjacent Euclidean time slices on your lattice, set up a source. You set some of the elements of a vector there to 1 and set the vector equal to 0 everywhere else, and use that as a source for a conjugate gradient inversion or however you like to compute quark propagators. And then, implicitly at least, multiply this source by some hadron spectrum operator, use the resulting thing for another quark propagator, and maybe even a third one if you're doing a nucleus. Now what we actually do in practice is use the same source for, well actually, the same space and spin dependence of the source for all three colors of our quark, and simply do it once for a red source, once for a green source, and once for a blue source. Now, we use what's called a wall source. So if this is my lattice, with staggered quarks, the actual periodicity is twice the naive one. So let's divide it up into 2^4 hypercubes. And let's gauge fix to Coulomb gauge. I want to do that so that quark propagators starting from this block will be coherent with those starting from this block out to whatever sort of natural length scale things are coherent in this gauge. And then we'll put the same source, same spin taste dependence in each of these blocks. And then out here at some point lattice, we'll calculate, I should have used a colored chalk, a red and a green and blue quark propagators starting from each of those, and demand that they all go to the same sink point. So we would call this a wall source and point sink, and throw in the anti-symmetric color wave function there at the end. Now you have a lot of, now why would you want to do this? Well, empirically, it gives good overlap with the ground state. How do you understand this? Well, the point sink, if you think in terms of non-relativistic quark model, is going to pick out states where all the quarks can be at the same point. So at least if you have a mess, it's going to pick out S-wave states. And that's what we expect our ground state to be. This thing is going to pick out states that have a fairly uniform wave function. So again, thinking about a meson and hoping the same logic carries over to nucleon, a ground state meson wave function would look like this, and we get the same sign contribution from all of these, where a radial excitation, if this is zero, might look like this. and get at least partial cancellation between propagators coming from different things.
So what source is the whole side of the lattice?
We just go all the way across. What you find is that things coming from very far apart on this aren't really coherent, even though you fixed the gauge. You only get alignment up to some sort of natural hadronic length in all of this.
I'm sorry, maybe I'm just waking up here, but I'm also confused. You have a global green, red, and blue on that small source?
Yes. Yes.
And you're trying to do what, a proton or something?
Yeah. Now, could one do better with a wave function that actually mimicked a proton wave function? Very likely you could. On the other hand, you would have to do a number of them, and what we're also going to do is sum this over all of the sync points in that time slice. But that doesn't contribute any new physics, that just contributes statistics.
Now, eventually, on the other end, on the point side, there's an epsilon symbol that is giving any symmetry.
That's right. There's a epsilon I J K, the one with the red source I, one with the blue source J, and the one with the green source K over there in the color there.
So that's why you need one of each, basically, from your point of view.
Mm-hmm. Now, the only naive problem I have with this is if the gauge parts in these different domains is really very different, so the different colors, then of course you can get artificially large gradients in gauge dependencies, which might not be a problem because you look at gauge invariant parts anyhow. So is that the right way of seeing it?
I'm not sure I see what you're saying about gauge dependence. It certainly is gauge dependent,
yeah,
in that we're using the gauge fixing to.
Well, it's because the color performance in each of these domains is really completely different. That's what you want. But
it's uniformly red all the way through.
Yeah.
And then just averaging.
It's fixed the gauge, so it's gauge invariant.
It's gauge, yeah. Well, because you project on the gauge invariant states anyhow.
Right. That's right. So it's a spatial gauge fixing. Different time slices are not.
It's correct.
It may not be optimal. It is correct. Yeah. There's no argument that it's optimal. The argument is that it's simple and relative to a lot of other things we could do, like point source and point sync, gives reasonable suppression of excited states in the propagator. Now, the question then arises, what spin and taste are you supposed to put in here? And we tend to use these propagators for all the particles we can think of, so the first thing we want to try is something that overlaps with everything. So just as a delta function in space overlaps equally with all momentum components, a delta function on one of these lattice points overlaps equally with all spin and taste components. So we take what we call a corner source and basically put a 1 at some chosen point in each hypercube. And that does seem to do a good job of giving roughly good overlap with essentially every particle you can think of. But another thing that arises more or less by accident when you start to compute delta propagators, you find yourself also computing propagators from what we would call an even source, where all the even sites have a 1 on them, and the odd sites have a 0 on them. And the long-term embarrassment about doing spectrum calculations that way is that you, if you're not careful, end up quoting different masses from the two sources. What I've plotted here on a lattice with a spacing of about 0.09 Fermi. Our mass is extracted from an exponential, a fit to this, where we have one simple exponential and one alternating exponential. The simplest thing you could do with staggered fermions. Plotted as a function of the minimum distance that you include in the fit. And, of course, if you try to include too short of points, it doesn't really fit an exponential. You get a terrible chi-squared. And the way we conventionally indicate that is with the size of the symbol we use, where a symbol the size of these characters down here indicates chi-squared of 1 per degree of freedom. That's on up to twice that size, indicating it's basically the confidence level or the probability that if everything was right, that you would get a chi-squared larger than that just by accident. So roughly speaking, any symbol you can see corresponds to a reasonably good fit, and the ones where you can't see the symbols are really bad fits. So it's pretty clear here that the corner source is working better for mysterious reasons, that this one appears to have higher overlap with some excited state. But then when you're actually trying to write a paper on this, you're given the task of choosing one of these points as the best fit and the one that you're going to quote. And not so much in this case, where you'd be tempted to throw away the even source as total nonsense anyway and pick one of the corner source points, but a little bit worse on some coarser lattices. Here's a similar thing on a lattice with a spacing of 0.12 Fermi at essentially the same physical quark mass, where if you did not have the red points, you would have been very likely to quote this mass. And so you see that you're fooling yourself a little bit about how good your quoted results are.
The bursts are also Gaskell proportional.
Yes. So again, this would be a fit with a perfectly good chi-squared here. I should also mention that because we have a different operator at the source end and the sink end, it's not surprising that these masses approach their asymptotic value from below. What that's telling us is the relative sign of the overlap of the source and sink operators with the excited state is different. In other words, the excited state is coming in with a relative minus sign to the ground state. That would be terrible if you had the same operators at each end. It would violate some fundamental physical principle, but it's perfectly okay here.
And the sink has parity even, or does it make a difference?
Yeah, this, well, of course, nucleon parity is always conventional, but it is.
You can label the size of your lattice by even or odd, just like you did at the source time slice, and the sink has a parity. Is that the same as the parity of the source?
We've summed over all sites here. Now, what I can't tell you is whether the even and odd sites are contributing equally. Mm-hmm. So I guess I don't know the answer to your question. We've summed them both in here. Okay, well, so how can we understand this? It turns out that what's happening is that I think that we're not really doing a very good job of getting rid of excited state contaminations by just going out and looking to where we first get a decent chi-squared. And I think the origin of this discrepancy is the different overlap with excited states. Now, another thing that this operator doesn't do very well is separate the nucleon and the delta. If you go back to Goltermann and Smith's original papers, where they looked at what representations of the lattice symmetry group are contained in the continuum delta, it turns out that essentially all of them are. Meaning that any propagator you write with this is going to contain some contamination of the delta, and we haven't done anything in designing this that would suppress that. And so, a tempting thing to think is that perhaps we have widely different amounts of delta admixture in these two different propagators and need to sort that out. And so, the first thing we think to do is we actually have measured the mass of the delta. It turns out there are lattice representations that don't contain the nucleon. So you can make an operator which picks out deltas and is insensitive to nucleons. And so we actually think we know what the delta mass is here. Although we have no idea what amplitude it's coming in with, we can add excited states to our propagator, fixing their mass to the delta mass. We're basically putting them in as a Bayesian prior, and see what that does to these fits.
The delta mass determination is free of problems like that.
The delta mass determination, of course, suffers from contaminations from excited spin 3/2 particles.
But when you do this, you see things like that for the delta?
We only have one source operator for the delta, so I couldn't answer that. Now, since that propagator only has spin 3/2 states, it's going to have fewer states in it and bigger spacings between them. In that regard, we'll behave better. On the other hand, it's massive and it involves nasty cancellations between propagators at neighboring spatial points, and so it tends to die out very quickly and you can't fit it very well anyway, so you have big error bars, statistical error bars hiding everything. But anyway, we took the delta mass, we inserted it in here as a Bayesian prior. So
has a probability to be something, but it's,
that's right.
Not a sharp one.
It's not a sharp one. So by this point we're fitting to a form let's call it A sub n. Since this is staggered, we always get parity partners. Where n prime and delta prime are parity partners, spin 1/2 or 3/2 particles with opposite parity to the nucleon. Okay, now it's going to take some time to disentangle the graph. The red points and the blue points are the same as on the previous graph. This is for the 0.09 Fermi lattice, what we call the fine lattice. And the green points there are what happened to the fits to the corner source things when we included the delta as an excited state, and the magenta points the same for the even sites. So this appears to actually have neatly resolved that discrepancy. Of course, then there's presumably the next state up, the Roper resonance would have to be disentangled from this. At the expense of giving you a considerably larger statistical error. You realize at this point that the very first numerical analysis I ever read was Numerical Methods That Work by Forman Acton. And he has a short section on fitting exponentials or fitting sums of exponentials, and his advice is that it's totally impossible, forget it. Unfortunately, since it's the only way we know to deal with this problem, that's not very useful advice, and we have to keep plugging ahead. Okay, now let's see. Let's do the same thing with the coarse lattice. It also works there. Well, it sort of works there. You see that basically on this lattice, we have few enough points in the even source propagator that attempting to add another parameter, even just an unknown amplitude, basically meant we got no sense at all out of this. So it appears to be, you know, a cure for the problem, but only a cure that works when you have a fine enough lattice and enough points in your propagator to fit that you can do this to it. Okay, so what else could we do? Well, you're probably thinking that the right thing is to do a simultaneous fit of all of these propagators and allow them all to have different amplitudes, but constrain them all to have the same masses. So that's actually what we're playing around with now. We fit the corner source propagators to the form that's written up there, the even source one to the same form with the same masses but allowing it to have different amplitudes, and the delta propagator to the same form except leaving out the terms with the nucleon and the parity partner to the nucleon. So it ends up being, I guess, a 14 parameter fit to roughly 60 data points. And yeah, it's not nice, but this appears to be what you're driven to.
Okay, so this is not old enough to know by years ago.
Right. What was put in as a prior into a fit just to the nucleon propagators before is now simply being used as more data points into a fit with more parameters.
And so you see a difference?
Well, do you see it? You don't see anything because you can't see the cyan points. Let me try to turn the light off.
That's a little bit perfect. Around the corner.
Okay. This is the same graph with yet one more thing added, which is what do you get if you just take all of these things and feed them to your fitting engine at once? Well, first of all, what you get is a program that takes a long time to run and a lot of massaging with initial conditions to get it to converge to something. But then these very light blue points are the results of that, which are, I guess, intellectually satisfying, but from a practical point of view, no real improvement on simply having taken the corner source propagator with the delta as a Bayesian prior. But it's nice to know that it still comes out roughly that way. What?
There's some light blue points that I'm
there, seeing.
Yeah.
There's here, they're offset just a little to try to make them visible in the others. Yeah, it was an unfortunate choice of colors for the one that's supposed to be the capstone of the whole thing.
You could just zoom on that particular color. Just increase from one go up to two. Just the quantification. Okay. Okay, so now anybody can see.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Herbert. Yeah, worked beautifully. Okay.
What's the red arrow?
The red arrow indicates that this was the point that before we looked at anything, any other propagators, we would have chosen as the best fit for the nucleon. That is, a fit with good confidence level. Clearly not significantly different from what you get if you vary the minimum distance by a little bit. And with a reasonably small error bar. Obviously, you could satisfy the first two conditions by just going out to something with huge statistical errors. Whereas after this whole exercise, you might be more inclined to have chosen this point to quote. How much do they differ? Well, it's written down in my notes. Turn my lights back on. If you just take the original one, the corner source and the point sink, the mass of the nucleon was, in lattice units, 0.5815, with an error bar of 19 on it, and a distance was fit was 10 through 25, so we threw away the first 9 time slices, hoping to get rid of excited states that way. And a perfectly good chi-squared per degree of freedom of 17 for 16. If you take the 3 propagator ones, where we were able to take the minimum distance all the way down to 4, and everything still looked good, with a chi-squared per degree of freedom of 46 for 43 degrees of freedom. Rather an awful mess to deal with there.
Units
of the inverse lattice spacing. Let's see, this was at a quark mass of 4/10 the strange quark mass, so this is something a little bit over a GeV for the new, for the baryon there. And so what has happened between the two is that we've basically swapped what up here we would have called a systematic error coming from neglect of excited states, in particular the delta, for a larger statistical error coming from when we included that. Don't know what to say about that. That's basically what happened. I think that's a good thing to do because we actually are much better at handling statistical errors than we are at handling systematic errors. We have a fair amount of mathematical machinery available to treat statistical errors, where the state of the art with systematic errors seems to be to try a few different kinds of fits and see how much they vary and quote the range. And two different people doing that exercise are likely to come out with two rather different answers. Unfortunately, I don't have any general conclusions about this. I think that this sort of thing is common to essentially all lattice spectrum calculations. And the only message is, as we go to higher accuracy and finer lattices, that it's also appropriate to try to upgrade the sophistication of the fitting we do and actually literally take into account all the stuff that we've known all along was there and have kind of been ignoring. Let me go on to one other small little point on this, which is that when I'm getting up to using 60 data points, these fits include all of the covariances or correlations between the different data points. And so I'm getting up to manipulating a rather large covariance matrix, 60 by 60. Now, the covariance matrix basically tells me how these data points are falling in a 60-dimensional space. I can't draw 60 dimensions, so let me draw 2. If I put 2 points in a 2-dimensional space, of course, I've got a pretty good idea, or some idea, of how much the data varies in this direction, but absolutely no idea of how much it varies in the other direction. If I did this in 3 dimensions, and I had 3 points, I would determine a plane, and have no idea how much the data was supposed to spread out in the fourth direction. This carries on up until I have more data points than I have, dimensions in this matrix. There's no hope of doing it. The covariance matrix is singular. And it doesn't instantly get all right as soon as you have one more data point than you have dimensions of the matrix. It actually stays problematic for a while. What you find is that you do a pretty good job of determining the directions in which it fluctuates the most. That's almost obvious. And a rather poor job of determining the amount of fluctuation in the directions where it's fluctuating the least. Unfortunately, all of those directions are contributing roughly equally to the chi-squared. And in particular, if you underestimate the small eigenvalues of this matrix, you will erroneously conclude that your data doesn't fit because you get a very poor chi-squared. Now, I was actually in a kind of a fortunate position by our standards here, in that I had 520 configurations to work with, and as far as we can tell, there aren't any significant autocorrelations among the nucleon propagators in them. They're sufficiently noisy that they're essentially independent on each lattice. That is incidentally not true if you try to look at the pions, which have much smaller statistical errors. And so I didn't really have to face this problem here, but in many lattice simulations with what we can do today, we do have to face it. And so the question is, what might you do about that? Yes, Tim?
Is this a case where you would try using SVD first to find out whether the small eigenvalues are actually really better than
common?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's one of the things you can try. That's actually not something we've tried. We tried something a little related but somewhat different, which is called a principal factor analysis. But I actually am not at all enamored of principal factor analysis after trying it. It's somewhat ad hoc. What you do is you first realize that some variables naturally have a bigger scale of fluctuation than others because they're naturally larger than others, especially when you're fitting an exponential. The short distance variables are considerably larger, or the points at short distance are naturally much larger than the points at small distance. So a fluctuation of 10 to the minus 14th at the long time end of the propagator is significant, but it wouldn't be at all significant at the short time end. So what you do, you start by rescaling the covariance matrix, by rescaling every dimension so that the diagonal element is 1. And this is where the arbitrariness enters with. You realize if you had used a different set of variables, you would now be doing something a little bit differently. Then you diagonalize that thing and throw away some number of the smallest eigenvalues.
By a criterion of various saturation?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how many? Do you have some numerical example? How many you have and how many you have to keep to get 90% of the variance?
I don't. Right. As I said, at least in this particular case, it didn't seem to help. And so I ended up undoing it. Now, in some other things we've done, this has been used, for example, in fitting the pseudoscalars, where we had another problem with lots of parameters. This was used in parts of it. But I personally ended up thinking that it's not much better than a number of other brutal and ad hoc things to do. For example, simply throw away some of the data points. You may have too many data points in your propagator to justify the statistics you're doing, and you may, well, not with staggered fermions, but with a pion where it's a simple exponential, simply throw away every other data point in the propagator and improve your... Not every other sample that you took, every other distance in the propagator.
Yeah.
and that way get yourself back into a regime where the statistics are reasonable.
The two things, I mean, you do it one using this factor and the other.
So I haven't actually done the same thing on the same problem. Another thing that aspect that this raises is when you do have autocorrelations, which did not show up in this particular problem, one of the things, the first things you try is blocking a number of data sets together. And of course, then you're stabbing yourself in the back by reducing the number of points you're using to compute your covariance matrix, and pretty soon you can't do it anymore. And I don't know a general prescription for handling this. What we usually end up doing is not blocking the data, and then by looking to see how diagonal elements of the covariance matrix scale with blocking, try to correct for this later. In other words, if the diagonal elements of a blocked covariance matrix have increased by 20%, you know that, and you assume that all elements would, then you know that by not blocking, you're underestimating your errors by 10%, and can go and put that in at the end. And that's actually something we end up doing a lot in these analyses to prevent ourselves from getting ill-conditioned covariance matrices. Okay, yes.
Yeah. Is there any reason why you have to throw away this small eigenvalues of the covariance matrix? And what's the criteria for
The reason is that they're not well determined. I unfortunately can't give you a quantitative statement about how.
How do you decide this is small enough?
Oh, okay. How do you decide? You start by keeping some number, and then you gradually increase the number, and look to see whether your estimate of the final error is saturating. See, these small eigenvalues are contributing very little to the error. They correspond to a possible direction of fluctuation that your data has chosen not to use, basically. Your data is not actually fluctuating in that direction. On the other hand, they're contributing just as much as any other mode to your chi-squared. And so if you get them wrong, you're quite likely to not get a good estimate of how good your fit is. And you're quite likely to become unreasonably discouraged because your fit isn't working when in fact it really should be working. So what you want to do is just assume that the thing is not fluctuating at all in those directions, take them out by principal factor analysis or singular value decomposition, and then convince yourself that you've really kept enough of them to account for essentially all of the variance in your final answers, which you do empirically by successively adding more of them in and seeing when your error estimates stabilize.
The usual way I think of using the principal factor analysis for SVD is to say you have a small eigenvalue, it's basically some parameter, some fit parameter that's just not determined by the data, and you don't want to have it moving at random and change the answer. But wouldn't there be some way of putting in something analogous to a Bayesian prior to say that the parameters have to have some reasonable values? Basically putting some extra constraint into the covariance matrix such that to get rid of them rather than just either including them or excluding them.
I have to admit I don't see what you're saying right now because it actually sounds backwards to me. The way I'm arguing is this is a parameter you don't need, not a parameter that you have to fix. The data has, in fact, done too good a job of fixing this fictitious parameter, if you like.
It's like the data has a hidden rule that is obeyed, and it doesn't go in the compiler space. But I mean, actually, in either case, you could take the view that what you're putting in is some prior assumption that this parameter has some natural variance in it, and that you don't want to. You consider it that the variance is much too big or much too small.
Yeah, we'll probably have to talk about this offline because I can't comment because I still don't understand the picture there. Yes?
You can kind of question. Your effective masses depend a lot on the choice of source, as you showed. And that indicates that the sink does a very poor job of projecting onto the ground state.
That's true.
So would it be worthwhile improving the sink, especially since a point sink is very counterintuitive in the context of staggered terminals? You know that your degrees of freedom are distributed over hypercube. Couldn't you just compute 8 quark propagators instead of 1?
Yes, this would be a good thing to do. I made a no-go statement about not being able to eliminate the delta completely. But one could do it to a large extent, I think, by simply asking, you know, what does a wave function for a spin 1/2 particle look like as opposed to a spin 3/2 particle?
And seems like a very cool guess.
Right. And that one. Yeah, that would certainly be another way to improve this situation. You might get yourself all the way to having to deal with this problem at the next level, which is the next thing you're going to want to know is what's the excited state of the nucleon, the third particle in the fit. And as soon as you eliminate the delta, you'll still have to go through all of this again, only now you'll be one state up doing one more interesting thing. But yeah, I think that'd be an excellent thing to do.
Could you go back to the first hypothesis,
please? Yes.
So you're plotting the fitted masses, not the effective masses. Is that right?
Right.
So there's an effective mass which you had somewhere, and these are the fitted masses from a single exponential fit.
Yeah, when we get back. Oh, wait a minute. That's correct. That's right.
So if I was to do a 2 exponential fit to the effective mass, so not necessarily find a Pavlov region, and the higher exponential, I don't constrain by Bayesian methods to be some particular part, but just to be something higher which represents infinitely many higher states. Is that what you're doing as a third path, or the third series path?
No. Everything that I showed was a fit from some minimum distance out to the distance where the propagator has disappeared into the statistical noise.
Fine, but I'm saying the number of exponentials you include, in one case you used a Bayesian method to constrain the higher exponential.
Right.
And then you said in the third case, you just let that be as a free parameter.
Right, but I included all three propagators into the fitting in that case.
So why don't you just try to do a 2 exponential fit here where the higher exponential is a free parameter? That's a fewer parameter fit. You don't necessarily have to go to the region where you have a plateau in effective mass.
Right.
You could include smaller T-min values.
I could do that. They don't generally converge very well. Again, it is the problem with an ill-conditioned fit when you have 2 exponentials with reasonably similar masses in them. So it was essential to get the thing to work to have information about the delta, either put in as a Bayesian prior, or because you were including a propagator in your fitting which only had the delta in it. Which carries with it the corollary that when you want to extend this to get the Roper resonance, that you are going to have to come up with source or sink operators which do reasonably good jobs of isolating the nucleon or the excited one. Which probably means you're actually going to have to put more physics into it than has gone into it up to this point. Okay, well, that's this.
So what's the argument against doing exponential fit that you mentioned from numerical methods that you need to do?
Oh. Simply the fact that it's an ill-conditioned problem. That is, there are directions in parameter space where you can change the exponentials together with their coefficients and still fit the data. So as soon as the exponents are unknown or don't have a good Bayesian prior to put in, the error bars just grow very quickly on that.
Okay.
No, it's nothing very sophisticated. It's merely an observation that...
Technique which one can use to test how reliable the bits are, which is to generate some totally fake data with some masses you choose and with some variances you choose, and then try to extract dual bits and see which ones reproduce the initial parameters. So that's usually a fairly good way of working out whether it's truly ill conditioned or not.
Right. But I don't think there's much doubt here that it's ill-conditioned. That's...
Okay.
All right, I'm done. That's it.
Thank you.